Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinsel. With the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and the expansion of Medicaid, there are tens of thousands of Vermonters seeking primary care physicians. But they're finding out that many practices are not taking on any new patients. What are the implications for this trend, and how could it change Vermont's healthcare system? These are some of the questions we have today for our guest, Dr. Alan Ramsey. Dr. Ramsey has been practicing medicine in Vermont for the past 30 years. He's a professor emeritus at the Department of Family Medicine at UVM. He's also a member of the Green Mountain Care Board, a group that oversees virtually every aspect of healthcare in the state of Vermont. Dr. Ramsey, welcome to the program. Great to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me. This is indeed a very important issue to my colleagues who practice medicine in Vermont, and in particular to Vermonters in general. Thank you.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Are you one of the thousands of Vermonters who've been unable to find a primary care physician because they're simply not available? And how have you handled this situation? Has it affected the healthcare services that you need? Perhaps you're a physician. Are you being asked to see more and more patients in a shorter period of time? And how has this affected your practice and your overall outlook on being a healthcare provider? 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. So, Dr. Ramsey, by most accounts, having a primary care physician is a very important part of every person's healthcare. But now we're seeing, when more and more Vermonters are coming into the healthcare system, that it can be hard, if not impossible, to find a primary care physician. Some people traveling 30, 40, 50 miles to find one. How serious a problem is this now in Vermont? Is this something to be concerned about from a public policy point of view?
Well, let me just address the first, before we get to the public policy issue, is how big a problem is this for Vermonters? Are we at a crisis state? Are we at a state where this is expected to lead to an unstable situation in the healthcare system? Now, there are pockets, there are places in Vermont where we are near a crisis level for obtaining certain primary care access. For instance, we recently heard about pediatricians leaving the St. Almas area because the payment system just did not allow them to have a financially viable practice. We've heard about Southwest Vermont down in the Bennington area that a year and a half ago had a real crisis in availability of primary care practices, and so had to adjust and had made a major effort at recruitment. Every place I go, and I have traveled throughout the state over the last 4 years, I ask hospital administrators, I ask practice managers, I ask my colleagues, are you recruiting more primary care providers? Everyone says yes. Now, let's be clear first for our listeners about what primary care is. Okay. Primary care is typically provided by family medicine, internal medicine, pediatrics, and some OBGYN practices. It is team-based care. Over the last 7 or 8 years, we have transitioned and transformed the home primary care model into one of teams. So I work with nurse practitioners, nurses, nutritionists, community health teams to provide continuous, comprehensive, and relationship-based care. That is primary care. It's not just the family doctor. Okay. It is team-based. That's critically important now. Number two, it has to be valued. It has to have, when you're providing that level of care, which every piece of evidence shows is going to improve the quality for Vermonters and reduce the total cost of care for Vermonters, when you're providing that, you have to provide adequate value to those who are participating in the primary care model. So, Vermont, there are pockets that need to be addressed. I don't think the state, you know, as a society, is at a crisis level yet. I think this is we're at a point in time where, from a policy perspective, we need to make major changes in how we value primary care, and we need to attract primary care clinicians to the state. I've recently reviewed the preliminary information from the Department of Health around the workforce. The Department of Health, when they relicense physicians, ask them to fill out a questionnaire. And we have recently been looking at the 2014 counts of full-time equivalent primary care providers, and that really hasn't been a big change from 2010 to 2014. But more people are insured, more people are in Medicaid, more people are aging, which puts more demand. It's not just the supply, it puts more demand on the system. That has to be addressed.
We've learned over the years that the Medicaid reimbursement rate for physicians is far below the cost of service. This situation causes some doctors to limit how many Medicaid patients they see. Does this make it even harder for people on Medicaid now to get access to primary care services?
Our primary care practices in Vermont have a long history of being willing to accept Medicaid, even at the very low and declining rates of reimbursement they get for Medicaid enrollees. So I am concerned, as we now have one-third of Vermonters insured by Medicaid. We have a primary care workforce that is struggling in some places in the state. I am concerned that those Medicaid patients may have greater difficulty. Now, what happens when they can't get in to see me in a primary care practice or see one of my colleagues? They go to the emergency room. They don't get preventive care. They don't get adequate address to mental health and substance abuse issues. They don't develop a relationship. All of the things that are critical to providing high-quality care.
Today in the program, we're looking at primary care in the state of Vermont. Our guest is Dr. Alan Ramsey, who has been a practicing physician in Vermont for the past 30 years, also a member of the Green Mountain Care Board. What are your thoughts about this subject? 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Todd in Waitsfield. Hi, Todd. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for taking the call. Welcome, doctor. This is an issue that has been going on for many years. It's not just a product of the ACA or Obamacare. I mean, primary care physicians in Vermont has always been sort of lacking. And with the climate in healthcare here in Vermont, I just see it very difficult to attract talent out of med school with great debt load and limited ability to pay for that debt load. And I'm curious, you know, what do you see is going to be different? 25 years, I mean, that's a whole generation plus. We've had this problem, and it's no different in specialty care, to be completely open. I do work in healthcare. I work in the business side of a specialty medical practice, and it's no different for the specialists. We're seeing a much, much higher caseload. We're seeing much sicker people, whether it's the attraction of Medicaid to come here and to have your ailments sort of addressed or whatnot is hard to know, but I just haven't seen anything programmatically that has changed it in 25 years, and I've worked in healthcare for 25 years. And just to put a point on it for you, doctor, yeah, patients do have a hard time getting to see a doctor. I was unfortunate enough to be hurt a few years ago, signed up for Medicaid. Closest doctor that I could get into was an hour and 15 minutes away. That was just not sufficient. And, you know, I had to bulldog my way, knowing what I know, to get to see somebody closer. And it was a real challenge, even with somebody that had the skills and knowledge to sort of navigate the system. So I'm curious to know what you bring to bear to change that. Programmatically, I don't see anything in, you know, reducing payments or increasing patient load that's going to solve this. So I'm curious to know what the care board sees.
Well, thank you, Todd. Though you've certainly brought up a lot of really key issues around change, around young physicians' choice of specialty, and you mentioned the debt load. You brought up the issue of how things are no different in the office you work in, the specialist office, versus the area that I have most of my expertise in, which is primary care. All I can say is that I go around the state and speaking to my colleagues, is there a crisis among my colleagues? It's whether the colleagues that you work with, the specialists, or the primary care practices in Vermont, is there a crisis? We are approaching a crisis. We have a system of payment called fee-for-service that demands more and more visits over shorter and shorter periods of time. We have a variety of different payment models. We have public payers, Medicare and Medicaid. We have commercial payers. All have different rules, all have different prior authorization requirements, which drives the administrative burden in practices way up. Now, and I hear that from my colleagues all around the state. I hear that. But you know when they really get energized? Whether it's an orthopedist or whether it's a family doctor. And they start telling the story that they saw a patient last week that had never had insurance, had never been eligible for Medicaid, but now they are. And they followed, not last week, but they followed them for the last 3 months, and they made the diagnosis of hypertension and diabetes, and they got that person under treatment. They made the diagnosis of depression. They got them on treatment. They kept the person's family life and their marriage intact. They sent them for a colonoscopy, and they found a polyp that might have led to colon cancer, and they prevented that. And that's the energy that our whole medical community has for what has happened with the Affordable Care Act and getting more people into the system. So that's when they really get enthusiastic. But at the same time, then they start describing some of these burdens. And it's not just about payment. It's these administrative burdens. They love what they do from 9 to 5. It's from 5 to 8 at night when they're clicking off boxes for measurement and performance, when they're making those calls back, when they're trying to get prior authorization, while they're resubmitting claims because every payer has a different claim system. Those are the things that we're working on. Those are the things that have to change.
Let's talk to Lewis, who is calling from Williston. Hi, Lewis. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Yes, I had my own primary care practice for many years. And two things, one comment, maybe two comments. One is that I think one of the big factors in reducing the number of primary care physicians is the huge growth in number of people going into hospital-based medicine. And some studies show that it's up to 50% of graduates from internal medicine programs now choose to be hospitalists, at least for the early parts of their career when they have large debts to pay off. These are people that in 20 years ago would have gone into traditional internal medicine where they not only saw patients in the office but were also taking care of people in the hospital. So the field of internal medicine is very much split now between hospitalists and primary care, and I wondered if Dr. Ramsey would talk about that. I think the second comment is, I had an experience when I was trying to find a young primary care doctor, a recent graduate, to come into my practice. I was shocked at the demands that they made in terms of what they expected. And really, they were looking for a 9-to-5 job. They did not want to work any after hours. They did not want to work weekends. I think that the expectations of people going into medicine has changed a bit. I'm just old enough to remember that when we went into primary care internal medicine, we recognized that it was going to be a very time-consuming career, but it was also a calling. And I think we accepted that. And I think the expectations of young graduates has changed. Now, I'll hang up and just take my... I'll stay on the line if Dr. Ramsey wants to ask any further questions.
And let me just add one thing, because Lewis was talking about expectations. You know, we hear from a number of doctors. We've gotten emails for this program from doctors who say they used to have an independent practice, but it's very difficult for them to maintain that. So they're now employed by the hospitals themselves, and they're being pushed into a situation where they've got to see more and more patients in a shorter period of time. And this is not exactly what they thought practicing medicine was going to be all about. Is that a problem here too?
Yes. Lewis, let me first address the hospitalist model of care and I certainly spent most of my career in primary care not utilizing a hospitalist. But again, most of my career was when the severity of illness and the complexity of the patient admitted to the hospital is a lot different than it is now.
Could you explain hospitalist as a term? Right. Because some folks might not be familiar with that.
A hospitalist is a general, usually internal medicine, sometimes family medicine specialist, who practices only in the hospital setting. So when you're admitted to the hospital, you fall under the care of the hospitalist. It's a new, relatively new specialty over the last 15 to 18 years. It has attracted a lot of internal medicine residency graduates, you know, because it is structured. It is basically time limited. There's no call. You don't spend a lot of time in billing and administrative burden. So it has been an attractive new specialty. Now, getting back to why we have that, and it does come down to the fact that less and less care is provided in the hospital, more and more care is provided in the outpatient setting, and those people who do require services within the hospital tend to require pretty continuous monitoring by an on-site physician. You know, when patients weren't as sick, I could go see them in the morning, make my rounds. If I needed to, see them later in the afternoon at the end of my practice day in the clinic, and that would be adequate. That is no longer adequate. So we have that hospitalist specialty. Now, you also, Lewis, brought up the question of how society has changed over the last 15 to 20 years in terms of expectation of graduates as they choose a medical career. The altruism has not changed. And when I mentioned how energized all the doctors and primary care clinicians that I visit around the state get when they really talk about the quality of care they're providing, that altruism hasn't changed. But society has changed, in that the expectation is that you can balance your career with the needs of your family and your social life. There's no doubt that has changed. That doesn't mean we can't have an integrated system that accommodates a really strong, vibrant primary care foundation for healthcare reform in this state. It doesn't mean that at all. We can do that.
Today on the program, we're looking at primary health care in Vermont. Our guest is Dr. Alan Ramsey. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. When we come back, we're going to take a look at some possible solutions to this approaching crisis. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. With me today, Dr. Alan Ramsey. Dr. Ramsey has been practicing medicine in Vermont for the past 30 years. He's also a member of the Green Mountain Care Board. We're looking at primary care in Vermont. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. Perhaps you're one of the thousands of Vermonters who've been unable to find a primary care physician. Give us a call. We'd like to learn more about your experience, how you handled it, how it affected the healthcare services that you need. 1-800-639-2211. So, Dr. Ramsey, we've talked about the problems that are out there and the new pressures on doctors, more people coming into the healthcare system. As you look at this overall problem, are you optimistic that there are some solutions that can be put into place that will help this situation?
Yes. How do we... You know, what are some of the solutions? Number one, I mentioned this payment system called fee-for-service. Moving away from only getting paid a fee for a specific service so that particularly the primary care practices can spend more time with the people with chronic medical problems that really need the time, that's going to be critical. I think leadership by the primary care community is critical. And we have seen that, whether it's the blueprint in the patient-centered medical home model, whether it's the accountable care organization model, where in order to be in an accountable care organization, you have to be attributed to a primary care practice or physician. I think leadership by the primary care community is there. That makes me very optimistic. What about a payment system that moves away from fees for service? Well, let's work on a payment system that provides fair and equal payment, whether you're caring for Medicare, Medicaid, or a commercially insured or privately insured patient. Okay. Let's work around a regional and orderly system of primary, secondary, and tertiary care. At the Greenmount Care Board, we call that a coalition of the willing who are participating in an integrated healthcare system, an orderly set of services. Let's have a payment system that involves some risks sharing, financial risk by the physicians and the primary care practices, but only put them at risk for the things that they can control: population health, preventive health, care management programs. That is another tool that we have. Let's make sure that we have appropriate resource allocation throughout the state. We don't have too many MRI machines, okay? We don't have too many cardiologists. And the board has some role for developing a statewide resource allocation plan, and we do a lot of that through our certificate of need process. And finally, let's focus on how we care for the most seriously ill Vermonters, those who have life-limiting conditions, who may be closer to the end of their life. A robust end-of-life care program is part of the solution here.
So there might be some people listening who are hearing this idea of payment reform and moving away from fee for service, but are a little confused as to how this whole thing should work. So let's give it an example. I'm your patient,
right?
I come to see you presumably when I'm sick. Maybe I need a knee replacement. So at the moment, all my interactions with the healthcare system with fee for service, there's a charge going out every single time. How under payment reform would it be any different?
Let's say I get a payment, it might be a per month payment, for every person that is attributed to my panel of patients, and that's called capitation, okay? So I get a fixed amount to provide you preventive health services, chronic medical health care services if you develop a chronic condition. I get paid a fixed amount. I only get paid that amount if I can prove that I'm providing you high quality care. Okay. Now, that's the accountable care model. As opposed to health maintenance organizations of 25 years ago, which I lived through, where I got a fixed capitation payment amount for each patient in my practice. I didn't want to have sick patients, and I didn't have any quality measures, and my patients really had to come and see me. Whereas in the accountable care model, in this new payment model, they can see any provider they like. There's freedom of choice. There'll always be freedom of choice for Vermonters to see whoever they prefer to see. There will always be quality indicators that define how much payment you are going to get on that capitation model. So it won't be just avoiding the sick patients. It will be providing the best quality care to all your patients.
You mentioned chronic care. We got an email from Mark who wrote us, "Would you agree that a major part of the process of reducing healthcare costs includes changing the expectation of patients, especially those suffering from chronic conditions, that they too must be accountable for their own health care and their own lifestyle choices?" I saw something the other day from the Centers for Disease Prevention Control that said 86% of all health care expenses in the United States are delivered to people with chronic illnesses. And the conclusion was, if you don't deal with this group of people and help prevent the disease from happening in the first place, or better manage the disease very proactively, this healthcare system is going to collapse. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that that's one of the primary roles of the primary care practice. That is the fundamental role, aside from population health and preventive health, mental health and substance abuse. It is chronic care management, and it's team-based. So everybody in the office works to the top of their ability. Everybody in the office trusts in the delegation of tasks for managing a sicker group of patients. Everyone is focused on that patient so that patient doesn't end up in the emergency room, doesn't end up in the hospital. That is primary care and its essence, is that ability to control those chronic diseases. Now, the second thing I kind of interpreted from that question, Bob, was that this caller felt like maybe he or she should, maybe we shouldn't be held accountable for patients specifically who have bad behaviors, who smoke, who don't take their medicines, okay, who are overweight, who don't exercise. Now, I hear that from my colleagues, too, around the state, because I mentioned risk, putting us at financial risk. How do you do that? How do you reconcile that with patient behavior? I'll tell you how. Number one, you get everybody into a primary care practice, which is a continuous relationship-based practice, which can address behavioral issues more effectively than when they're just seeing in an episodic care program. Number two, you ask the payment system to provide some value-based benefit design. What I mean is that there is low or no cost sharing by the patient for essential medications to take care of their cholesterol, take care of their heart disease, take care of their diabetes. If I have a patient and I write them a prescription and they have a high cost sharing plan and they're only taking that medicine every other day, that is not adding value to the system. So assign everybody to a primary care practice, have a viable, well-functioning workforce, use value-based benefit design, and behaviors can change. Not everybody's, but I will do a lot better in that system than I will in a fee-for-service system.
So how do you design a system where the out-of-pocket cost for the consumer is a reasonable amount? We see right now with different policies that are sold in the state of Vermont. In fact, we did get an email from Keith who talked about your vote against the rate increase for Blue Cross for folks on Vermont Health Connect, because you said the rate increases and out-of-pocket costs at Vermont Health Connect are not affordable. So, I mean, just speaking to what you just said, so how do we design a system where all these costs are affordable? Who's going to pay for it?
Well, the key statement there is affordability. And we are now facing a crisis in affordability for all Vermonts, for all Vermonters. Whether it's increase in payment to Medicare Part B that we're hearing about, whether it's the premiums that we have to review and adjust whenever we can, whether it's the out-of-pocket costs, that is the real crisis, is the cost trends of healthcare, delivery of healthcare in Vermont. That has to moderate. That is what one of our primary goals in our regulatory capacity as the Green Mountain Care Board is to not stop the increased growth in healthcare costs, but moderate the trend so that it becomes more affordable. Now, how do we do that? We get all payers working together. We are currently engaged in discussions with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation around an all-payer model. Remember, one of the solutions is the equalization of payment for patients with Medicare, Medicaid, and privately insured coverage. Equalize that, somehow balance it out so that you can start to look at bending that cost curve so that commercial insurers don't have to offset the decrease in payment that we all get from Medicare and Medicaid. Now, some of that is a legislative issue, and certainly around Medicaid payment for particularly primary care services, that is a huge issue. The Affordable Care Act allowed primary care physicians to be paid at Medicare rates for Medicaid patients for the first 2 years. That changed on January 1, 2015, which automatically reduced Medicaid payments to all of my primary care colleagues in Vermont. And it dropped it a significant amount. Okay. Several states agreed to offset that, to continue that enhanced payment for primary care. Vermont didn't. That's a legislative issue. That is a crisis. When you start seeing, and what did we see? We saw pediatricians leaving the St. Albans area. Pediatricians in particular get hit with the Medicaid side. We family doctors have to deal with both Medicaid in the young and Medicare in the older population. But that's what we saw.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Gretchen, who is calling from South Burlington. Hi, Gretchen. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm a primary care physician who's firmly committed to primary care, UVM grad. Hi, Dr. Ramsey. And I'm calling to discuss a different delivery model that was used and has been used around the country, but has not become very popular, I don't think, yet in Vermont. And so I practiced in Massachusetts for 6 years and was involved in the launch of what we call shared medical appointments in Massachusetts. And what it is it's a very unconventional model, but sort of goes on the idea that patients will often listen to their peers more than their physician sometimes. So what it is the series of individual visits with observers. So I provided this type of care for men and women for physicals and also mixed groups for chronic disease management. So what it looks like is 10 to 12 individuals in a room, fully closed, with a team of myself, a behaviorist, so that could be a nurse or a dietitian or a mental health specialist, as well as a nurse who would administer immunizations and draw blood. And then also I would have a scribe who would be typing as I'm talking to the patient. And I enjoyed this model of care because it allowed me to have face-to-face time with a lot of my patients, but it provided me with a lot of support. And the climate there was much more capitated, so there wasn't a pressure. Well, it just seemed to work better because we were focused on the quality measures and keeping costs down. A lot of patients who were skeptical about it did come and enjoyed it quite a bit, and I actually had a few breakthrough moments with patients in those sessions. And what it did is allowed me more time in a busy practice to see one-on-one the patients who either couldn't participate in a group or wasn't appropriate medically or they chose not to. So I'm actually going to be doing this model at the Veterans Administration here in Burlington starting next week.
Well, thank you, Gretchen. And you bring up a point, a very important point about the delivery system. And you mentioned capitation and group visits. The thing that changes the delivery system in the most consistent way, there are some critical points here. Number one, the best changes in the delivery system come from those who are actually providing the care, like you, like what you did in Massachusetts. They don't come from policymakers. They don't come from administrators. They come from those clinicians actually doing that. Those are the best ideas in how we change the delivery system to reduce the cost of care, okay? Number two, payment. The way we encourage and enhance the changes in the delivery system that can really help Vermonters is changing how we pay for health care, which you experienced in Massachusetts in this capitation plan. So I thank you for telling us about this. In a fee-for-service system, we would never get adequate compensation for group visits. In a capitation or a population-based system, you can be those things can be valued effectively.
Got less than a minute left. Are you optimistic as you look ahead to the next 5 years? Are you optimistic that these changes that you've talked about today can actually be put into place and will be put into place?
Yes, I am optimistic. I have a lot of reasons to be optimistic, but let me just say from a policy perspective, Vermont has a coalition of the willing. Whether it's shared savings programs, whether it's the ACO, whether it's the Blueprint, the patient-centered medical home, the hospital association, all working together to achieve the same goal. Number two, we have the highest quality primary care practicing physicians and practices of anywhere in the country. I am optimistic.
Dr. Alan Ramsey is a member of the Green Mountain Care Board. He's been a practicing physician in Vermont for the past 30 years. Many thanks for being on the program today.
Well, thank you.
Coming up next, I'll talk with 7 Days columnist Paul Heintz about some of the key developments this week in Vermont political news. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. It's been quite a week for political news in Vermont. The race for lieutenant governor is attracting more candidates, and Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders participated in his first full campaign debate with Hillary Clinton. Here with us now to discuss the world of Vermont politics is 7 Days columnist Paul Heintz. Paul, great to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
So, Paul, let's start with the race for lieutenant governor. It's an open seat in 2016 because incumbent Republican Phil Scott is running for governor. On the Republican side, former state auditor Randy Brock has announced his intentions to run for governor. What are your thoughts about his candidacy? He did run for governor back in 2012. Will he be a strong candidate?
You know, I think he could well be. A recent Castleton poll suggested that he's one of the better-known Republicans in the state. He's certainly run for statewide office a couple of times now. I think he's relatively well-known. He knows how to run a statewide campaign. You know, one question is, who exactly will he be facing on the Republican side? And we don't know the answer to that question yet, so it may be a little bit early to gauge his chances. But certainly he's got a lot of the strong fundamentals as a campaigner, so I think he could be a real factor.
Who are some of the people who might be in that race, some Republicans who are considering running for lieutenant governor?
Well, we're at this stage of the race where most politicians in the state are considering running for lieutenant governor, and that's true on the Republican side as well. There are some folks who've suggested that Joe Benning, senator from Caledonia County and the minority leader of the Senate, could get in. Mark Snelling, who had run for lieutenant governor before, had considered it, but he has pulled his name out of the race. And I'm sure we'll hear lots more names as this goes forward.
So let's look at the Democratic side now. The first candidate in the race was political newcomer Brandon Riker of Brattleboro. He's already raised more than $100,000 for his campaign. Most of it came from Riker and members of his family. What do we know about Brandon Riker?
Well, not a heck of a lot. He was virtually unknown in political circles before he announced that he was going to be running for lieutenant governor. That said, as you pointed out, he clearly has tremendous personal financial resources that he's willing to invest in this race. So you certainly can't count him out, even though I think it's fair to say that most Vermonters have no idea who he is. He is saying he's from southern Vermont. He's saying that even where he operates his business, he doesn't have much of an internet connection. So he's really focusing on this message of we need to provide the infrastructure to allow businesses to succeed. He does have some political experience as a campaign volunteer and staffer on President Obama's campaigns and some Senate campaigns. But like I said, very little experience in Vermont politics.
Then this week, you first reported that Burlington Representative Keisha Rahm would be a candidate for lieutenant governor. She has served 4 terms in the Vermont House from Burlington. Are you surprised that she decided to run?
You know, what I'm most surprised is how early she decided to get into the race. You know, like I said, a lot of people have been throwing around the notion of running for lieutenant governor. Most of them won't end up doing so. Most of them, I think, just like the idea of it. I was a little surprised that Keisha Rahm got into the race this early. But it makes a certain amount of sense, right? I mean, if you've got people – you've got so many people considering it, why not throw your name in there and then really change the calculation? Anyone else who's getting in is now just – isn't just running against Brandon Riker and unknown. They're running against someone who has clearly got good political instincts, who's – well-known within the Democratic Party and probably pretty well-known in Burlington, if not all of Chittenden County. So I think the timing was the most surprising thing.
As you mentioned, there are a lot of Senate Democrats who are looking at this race. Chittenden Senator Philip Baruth, Windsor Senator Dick McCormick, perhaps Addison Senator Chris Bray. Do you think any of these 3 candidates will get in the race?
You know, it's hard to say at this point. I've talked to a number of them, and at this point, Senator Baruth to me sounds like the most serious of the ones that you've mentioned. He says that he's trying to find a little bit more clarity about how the public financing law works because he really wants to use that if he is to run. The other person who has been talking quite a bit about this is David Zuckerman, state senator from Chittenden County. who, you know, actually represented the same House district as Keisha Ram many years ago. And he says he's looking both at running with public financing, perhaps without it. And both he and Senator Baruth would run in the Democratic primary, but would also seek the progressive nomination if they were to run. And I think that's a way to make sure that the progressives and Democrats don't split the vote.
Paul, are candidates who would like to take public financing, are they kind of in limbo right now? Because under state law, are they allowed to announce their candidacies before February 1st?
They are not. So the public financing law is fairly complicated. And one of the restrictions is you cannot announce your candidacy before next February. And you're also restricted in how you can raise money and who you can accept money from. So one of the things that Senator Baruth says is he wants a little bit more guidance about whether, for example, the Democratic Party or the Progressive Party could spend resources on his campaign. Now, if you recall, a lot of this goes back to the last election cycle when Dean Corin, a progressive who won the Democratic nomination, used public financing quite well to his benefit. But he ended up getting tripped up on some of the rules towards the end. And after the election, the Attorney General, Bill Sorrell, said that he had violated public financing law and sought some pretty serious fines from him. So, you know, I think there are a lot of good things about public financing for candidates. You can get up to $200,000 if you're running for lieutenant governor. That's a huge boost. But I think some people are looking at this a little bit warily, saying, you know, first of all, am I going to get in trouble? Am I going to get fined if I cross the line here? And they're also thinking, you know, if you've got Brandon Riker spending a ton of his own money, you've got Keisha Ram, who is not using the public financing system, is it a good strategic decision to live by those restrictions that the law requires?
Paul, this week we also saw the first Democratic presidential debate taking place, first time that Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton met on the same stage for a debate. Stakes were pretty high for both candidates coming into this debate. In your opinion, how did these two candidates do?
Well, you know, I think they both did very well. I think that the universal sentiment out of the Washington, D.C. reporters was that Hillary Clinton stole the show, that she clobbered everybody else. You know, I had a bit of a different take on it. I thought that while Hillary Clinton did quite well, Bernie Sanders did what he needed to do. He did not make any major mistakes. He was introducing himself to a ton of people who had just never heard him before. 15 million people watched this debate. It was the highest rated Democratic debate in history. And so what he really had to do was get out there and send his message, which I think he did quite well in his opening statement and on questions that related to sort of his strong suit, which is economics, income inequality, regulating Wall Street, and that sort of thing. If you look at some of the metrics that I've seen posted since the debate, he did very well in terms of people searching for him on Google. More people searched his name than any other candidate. More people signed up as his Facebook followers after this debate. And his famous line about how the American people are sick and tired of Hillary Clinton's damn emails was the most tweeted line of the night. So I think he got a lot of attention, and I think he kind of did what he had to do in a lot of ways.
Do you think the question about gun control seemed to put him a little off balance early in the debate, particularly in light of his opposition to the Brady Bill and his support for legislation shielding gun manufacturers from lawsuits?
It definitely did. There were two moments where I thought he really kind of struggled, one of which was on foreign policy questions. You know, he tried to sort of move questions on foreign policy to his vote against the war in Iraq, obviously setting up a contrast with Hillary Clinton. But he wasn't really able to speak with much depth about the Syrian crisis. And I think that's something that's going to continue to haunt him going forward, in part because he just hasn't really focused on foreign policy issues throughout his career. The other issue, as you note, that I think he really struggled with was gun control. You know, what's most surprising about this is he should have been able to see this coming. I mean, this has been a very big issue in the Democratic primary for months. And Senator Sanders has had a really difficult time explaining his record. At times he says, well, I'm from Vermont. Of course, I have kind of a checkered record on this. At the debate, he really tried to say, well, no, actually, I've been very strong on gun control throughout my entire career. But that really set Hillary Clinton up and the debate moderator Anderson Cooper to point out the fact that he had voted against the Brady Bill five times, that he'd voted 10 years ago to shield gun manufacturers from liability. And he said something that was very un-Bernie Sanders. He said that that gun liability bill was very large and complicated. And that's not the kind of thing you usually hear from Bernie Sanders, right? Usually he's saying, this is what I stand for. This is what I believe in. And he sounded like he was more of a politician there, trying to explain his way out of the situation. You also had Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland, really going after him on that gun issue. So he was taking it from all sides. And I don't think he came across looking very strong on that particular issue.
Paul Heintz is a political columnist for 7 Days. Paul, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
That's our program for today. Coming up on Monday, the state of Vermont is asking for public input on an updated comprehensive energy plan. We'll look at that plan and ask for your thoughts on the state's energy future. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sangari and Sam Gale Rosen. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.